We sit this in the back of the room along with some 3x5 cards and some pencils, and what we like to have you do is if you have questions about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you write those questions down, you put them in the box. We pick a question each week to be answered using AA-approved literature and our own panel of experts. To answer this week's question, Valley Group's own Steve.
Hi, I'm Steve. I'm an alcoholic. This one, for me, in my experience, is pretty simple. How long do you need to stay sober before you know the program is working? Well, I guess the best word is forever. You know it by every day getting up, doing the things that you need to do to stay sober, work the program. How many people in here is the program working for? Okay, whoever wrote the letter, just look around. How many people in here know this continue works for you if you work it? How many think it'll work for you if you don't? So length of time is every day for the rest of your life. Thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is now time for our featured speaker of the evening. This is brought to you by the Valley Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, the undefeated, undisputed king of speaker meetings. This event is brought to you for your sobriety pleasure. And now, let's get ready for recovery. Our speaker has been a sober member of the fellowship since 11-17-02. He has been active in groups in Bakersfield, Hermosa Beach, Redondo Beach, and Torrance. He's an active sponsor and a founder of the Bakersfield Young People's Group. And now, with all the earnestness at your command, will you welcome, please, from Bakersfield, California, Aaron M.
Aaron, alcoholic. I was telling Dan on my way up here, I said, man, there was something I remembered about that Visalia group, and I couldn't quite put my finger on it. And then when I got reintroduced to Mark, it hit me square in the face. So you guys do one hell of an introduction. This is an awesome group, and it was an easy, it was a no-brainer when Bill asked me to come back and speak. I immediately wanted to. It's well worth the drive. You guys have an awesome group here, and I can tell by just the energy of everybody in this room tonight and how many people there are here. I always have to do kind of a double take when I'm in rooms this big or Alano clubs like this or big rooms, just because I grew up as a child, as a kid, in the back rooms just like these, because when I was a kid, my parents were just trying to get sober and figure their own sobriety out, let alone raise their own kids. So we were playing around wondering why there's so many disgruntled people smoking in a dark room, you know, listening to somebody at a podium. So, and that was back when the Alano Club back in Bakersfield, I think, had like arcade games or stuff for kids, so it's kind of a cool place to hang out. But I'm going to stick to what I was always taught, that you share about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I hope in whatever I bring to the group, you find some similarities and you kind of dissuade against the differences, because that's what kept me coming back, was the similarities, because we're not all alike, but there's some big red flags that kind of are commonalities. So I'll start right there with, like, as I mentioned, growing up in rooms of AA, I had no exposure whatsoever to alcohol at a young age. Me and my sister never even knew what alcohol was except from seeing it on TV. It was never in our house. We usually weren't allowed to hang out with kids that had it, things like that. So it's kind of a sheltered, kept away thing from us. But it was just something, if you've never been exposed to it, you don't really have an opinion one way or another about it. But in Bakersfield, I don't know how it is in Visalia, once you get to high school, there's not really much to do except drink and party. So that's what we did once I got to high school, was we got set on drinking and partying. And that's, at least when I first came into rooms, is the first thing I noticed amongst all the stories of the similarities, is I can remember to like the exact instant how it felt, how good it felt for my first drink. And I know that was something out with my normie friends. If you ask some of my normie friends what it was like their first drink, they'd have probably a hard time recalling the event. But for me, like my dad always would share, it was truly a spiritual experience for me. I had grown up, as I mentioned, you know, in a family of alcoholics, but I had grown up never quite fitting in, never feeling like I was a part of, always depressed, never knowing why. Never feeling I was a part of the group that I wanted to be, going through school, going through Catholic school. And when I got to high school, it was the same thing. And I didn't know when I was going to find something, someone, whatever it was, to make me feel comfortable with who I was and, you know, make me happy, because that's what I was really searching for. And I feel like it's kind of strange being so young and so unhappy. And I don't know if anyone can relate to that, but that's what my childhood and early teens were like. But I can remember my first drink was with a few of my friends at a buddy's house over the summer going into our freshman year, and I remember being handed a big bottle of Kirkland vodka from Costco, and just taking a big old swig. And I remember there was never a sense of happiness so fast and so pure as that first moment of a drink. And I just remember just all the depression, anxiety, and fear that I was going through as a young adult, and it always felt and always carried, just kind of washing away. And that's what our book talks about, this disease, and that really being a sense of dis-ease. And if I can relate it to anybody else, my first drink was the first sense of ease and comfort I had ever gotten in the 14 years or so of being on this earth. You know, I finally felt like a part of, I finally felt like I fit in, or I was comfortable with who I was. And I finally felt like the people around me really liked me, even though that wasn't who I was. And from just like my dad had shared, who came up here, the first time I drank, it was the first time I blacked out. It was the first time I threw up all over my sheets. And that was pretty much a continuous pattern through my drinking. There wasn't much of a stop there. Because I don't know about anybody else in this room, but if I have something that makes me feel that good, why would I want a small amount? You know, I only want more of that on a more consistent basis and as often as I can get it. And I only want to hang out with people that want to drink like I want to drink. Now, most of my drinking was throughout high school. I had the blessing, I think now, I didn't think then, of having two parents who grew up in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So they sure as shit weren't going to enable me or enable my drinking. I remember my dad always saying that if you're old enough to drink, you're old enough to work. So right when I first started drinking was right when I started working. And I won't stand here at a podium and tell you getting a job will get you sober, because I dug plenty of trenches and went right out afterwards to get drunk, because a job won't get you sober. But that did help, though, because I tell you what, it hurts a lot more getting thrown in a pickup truck to go on job walks or dig trenches with a hangover than it does just sitting in your bed and having your mom tend you. I don't know if that's somebody else's story, but that's not mine. So that went through that way through high school, and my parents put up with my shit as long as they could. A couple of kids at my high school died of DUIs, accidents as a result of that, so that freaked them out. We started seeing a family therapist about my drinking and seeing what type of safeguards we could put up for Aaron's drinking and maybe him killing himself or getting in a car and dying. And I'll never forget that moment, because it was the most awesome statement I'd ever heard up to that point. Was our therapist put forth the idea, well, if you're so concerned with Aaron drinking and dying in a DUI accident, why don't you guys just always pick him up and drive him home from wherever he's at sober, and he'll never die of a DUI accident and he can drink. And I couldn't sign up fast enough for that shit, because that just meant I got to drink as much as I wanted and I was going to get a safe ride home. I mean, I had never paid attention in therapy before, but I was sure shit paying attention now, you know. And Dad, of course, left the room because he was going to have no part of it. And if anyone was here listening to Dad speak last time, you know why. But Mom and my sister, you know, another, okay, well, we'll put up with this because it's a phase. It'll burn itself out. And it didn't. That was a green light for me. I can remember my sister, I was at a party, passed out, and I blacked out. And I'm not the lightest guy on the planet. I'm about $1.80, $1.90. Danielle having to drag me down a couple of flights of stairs to the car, get me in the car, throwing up in her car, you know, helping her clean it out the next day. But that's not a recipe for a happy family. But I thought it was, because everybody was working around shit I wanted to get done and shit I wanted to do. So it was working pretty good for me. I thought I was happy, and that's what I would hope anyone would take from that, is I thought that's what happiness was making my entire family work around me. You know, as long as that went well, and only when that went well was I happy. When that came off the tracks was when I was depressed, was when I was suicidal, was things like that, and all to do with my alcohol use. I'll jump forward to, you know, senior year in high school, and as Mark mentioned, my last drink was November 16th, 2002 was my last drink, and I remember going to that party. Thank you. I remember going to that party. It was our senior year, and thinking there's and me and Dad had gone back and forth all through high school. Him telling me I was an alcoholic, him telling me I was going to die drunk, and me just saying you're full of shit. You're only saying that because you're my dad. You drank hard alcohol for a while. I drank beer, and I had that over his head. But then everybody knows you switch pretty quick when you find out how fast it works. So then I switched, and then I was still saying I was working, so how could I be a drunk? I had straight A's through high school. I had everything to throw back in his face, but it was all a lie because I was really becoming exactly who my dad had been all along, and I was becoming a fearful, depressed drunk in high school, which is no way to live. And I remember that last party, that last drink, going in there thinking, I'm going to prove Dad wrong. I'm not going to drink this time. Then when I got there, it became, well, I'm not going to blackout drink. I'm just going to have a few drinks. And it was the same thing. And I remember getting dropped off. My friends had gotten so sick of dropping me off or taking me to the front door, they dropped me off on the sidewalk at my house. And, you know, my dad or mom, I think, came out. They heard the car pulling away, and they saw me. They begged them to come help me carry me in. My mom's crying from what she tells me. I don't remember. And they put me in the bed, and I fell asleep, threw up all over the sheets again, and that was my last dream. I should tell you that before that, I'd been put into AA by my parents because they said, if we're going to continue this bullshit program of taxi driving you, you're going to go to AA and see what it's all about. And I remember sitting in meetings just like this, speaker meetings, and looking at the speaker and saying, oh, that's not me. I don't have any DUIs. I don't have any arrests. I'm not divorced yet. I barely could hold a girlfriend relationship together, let alone get married. So I thought, it's not me, and there's no association. But if I had really listened, I would have heard all the stuff the speaker was saying was happening inside them, and it was the exact same person. I was scared, I was fearful, I was depressed, and I hated who I was, and I needed a substance, you know, whatever it is in this room, but I'll talk about alcohol. I needed alcohol to feel okay. And that's sick. I mean, I see that now, that's sick, that I couldn't be comfortable with who Aaron was without putting something else inside me, you know. So, and then, well, like I said, it took a long time, and I remember that last drink the morning after thinking that I was having Bill's burning bush experience, you know, because I remember I hadn't cried in a long time and just pouring down tears because as somebody who always, I think when we come in here, we always say, oh, I have the willpower to stop it. When you finally have to surrender and give up, that's a crippling thing at first. At first, it really is. And I remember just bawling my eyes out because I felt I had no willpower. You know, I'd later find out I don't really need that to survive. I don't need to survive on Aaron's willpower, but that's getting ahead of myself. And I remember getting sober in my senior year, going through winter formal, prom, graduation, all that sober, and really hating it because I had no sponsor, I had no program, and I think anyone in this room will tell you that just staying sober doesn't guarantee happiness. Up until recently, someone also told me that the only condition for membership to our group is a willingness to stop drinking, but that's not the only condition for sobriety or happiness. And for me, happiness is important. You know, so if you want to just try to be part of this group, maybe you can just have a willingness, but I need more than that. I need to do more. I need to be more active, you know, to get the happiness that I traded in for, because that's what I did. I traded alcohol for a different solution. And I remember getting my first sponsor. It was a guy, a really young guy, in AA, but a great guy, a good friend of mine, and he relapsed right up into my fourth step, which is a great time to have your sponsor go out on you. But I can't own his stuff. I'll own my stuff. Is that I use that as the biggest bullshit excuse not to finish a four-step that anybody's ever done. And I put off doing a four-step for about 2 or 3 years, you know, because I always said, well, this guy went out on me. This guy betrayed me. You know, I don't want to put everything I've got, all the bad shit that's happening, all my resentments and fears, into somebody who's just going to go out. But we're not promised much more than one day. So I was holding him to a higher standard than our program does. So it took a while for me to finally get comfortable with another guy and get actually active in what our program talks about is working a program. And I met a guy, Joe. We started working the steps together, and he could sense that You know, I'll tell you one thing. The worst thing is long-term sobriety, long-term not drinking without sobriety. That's the worst thing, feeling the world. Because now you've taken away one solution and you have nothing else. And that's what I was going through. Thank God for the fellowship. I stayed close to groups, stayed close to other people. Didn't work a program, but was so close I'd feel so bad to go out. And that's what kept me sober for so long. That's a sick reason, but that's what it was, you know. So, but I started working a program. We got right up to that fourth again. And I'll harp on the fourth just because it's a trouble area for a lot of people, and it was a huge trouble area for me, and that's why I bring it up, is it took a lot for me to see everybody, my part in it, I should say, in everybody else's stuff. Dad had always told me, well, you'll see the fourth column and shit like that, and I thought, well, there are so many instances in my life I had nothing to do with, but that's all a lie, you know. You do that fourth column, you start really writing it down, and you realize you played a part in every single thing that you did or happened to you in one way or another. And I hated looking at that. And our book tells us we're the only type of people that will put our most wretched stuff down and have the opportunity to get rid of it, and we'll hold stuff back. We'll say, I'll give you everything else, but I'm going to keep these three really horrible things about me because you don't want to hear them. It'll change your opinion of you. Of me, and that was exactly what happened. Even getting that close with a guy like my old sponsor, and he could sense it. I started having panic attacks. I don't know if this is anybody else part of their story, but it's mine. Horrible panic attacks to where I would just was debilitated. You know, I couldn't stop crying, or I would just freak out and was locked up. And I remember one panic attack happening when I worked at a store in Bakersfield. And I called a guy in the program. I said, hey, man, I don't know what to do, but I can't get off the ground, and I can't stop crying because I'm thinking of these things I've done, and I don't know who to turn them over to because I had no faith in a God because I hadn't built that relationship. And he came over, and I only tell this story because I'll be hard-pressed to think of any of my friends back when I was drinking that did what he did. He was there like that and stayed with me for my entire 8-hour some-odd shift, watching me go through all these horrible emotional issues right in front of his eyes, and had no problem being there with me. Didn't ask anything more, didn't ask anything in exchange for it, because that's what I'd always had before that, is relationships that were conditional on what I could give you or what I could get from you. And that's not what this program's about, and I can tell from the group here that's not what this AA is about. But that got me to the point where I had to go back to Joe and say, I'm not working an honest four-step. You know, I'm not giving you everything I've got, and I don't know if I can because I don't feel that level of trust with you. And I'll use this as an example because people will get caught up on this fourth and think, well, if I don't give it to my sponsor, what can I do with it? I'll sit on it. I'll do it next fourth step, even if it's tearing you up inside. And he said, there's a priest in Oildale you can go to. If you're not, don't trust me as much, he's got a legal obligation to never say what you got to tell me. And that was all that I needed. I called him. He's in the program. He saw me that afternoon. He said, I'll block it out. We'll sit down. And I went to Oildale, which I don't know if anybody's from Oildale or been to Oildale. Yeah. It's not where you'd think you'd find, you know, a spiritual solution or real good sobriety, but I went and saw a priest there in Oildale, and he sat with me, and he heard me unload a few things, and he just shook his head, and he said, Aaron, I can't believe you've been holding on to this for how long. And up to that point, I've been holding on to it about 6 years, some of the things that I'd done or people had done to me that I didn't know who to talk to about. And it was that kind of fear and anxiety that almost sent me out at that much time. And to finally relieve myself of that was, I can't describe it. I can say that it was almost as much happiness as that first time drinking. It was close to that, and it's the closest I've had really since then. But those are the blessings of sobriety that we get when we really work a program. I know that a lot of people will tell you that you got to do this, you got to do that. I can just tell you from my experience, is that you only get out of this program what you give, put into it. And that's the easiest and simplest way to put it, because I did a long time putting very little in and thinking I could just get by with not drinking. But if you're coming in here just to not drink, I hope that lasts for you. But I know for me, I needed to get happy. I needed a new solution, and that's what AA was for me. That's when, you know, working a better program came into effect. That's when, you know, working the steps, working with others. I apologize to Mark. I haven't done as many GSR service requirements as some people, but I can tell you one thing, that the guys that I worked with in the program, guys that worked with me, told me from the very beginning, if you have any problem, the first thing you should do is work with others, because it'll make that problem seem insignificant, or it'll give you the relief that you need. And I tell you what, in the last year and a half or so, I lived in Los Angeles for about 4 or 5 years, I'll say that, just because then moving back to Bakersfield, I came back to work for my family's business, and working with your family, with two other recovering drunks, and then you, and then I lived with them for my first 3 months back in Bakersfield. So you're living with them, working with them, and we're all in recovery, was one of the worst things for maintaining happiness, you know, on the planet, but it was every time one of those issues would come up, it was calling another guy. It was reaching my hand out, saying, how can I help somebody else, you know, stay sober, or just talk to him, just ask him how their day's going. Because Aaron's shit isn't the most important stuff in the world. You know, and you realize that when you talk to other people. But I'll say that's, you know, for me, happiness today is something I never thought it was almost 10 years ago. Because 10 years ago, happiness for me was getting a drink, you know, doing other substances, things like that, but it had nothing to do with who I really was. And now today, I find happiness in being me, I find happiness in helping others, doing things for other people. And I'm going to say right now, this is the first time I've been a 45-minute speaker, so if anybody had the under, it's probably going to go under. So I want to end before it goes bad, but thank you so much for inviting me up. We'll get to the coffee early. Dad said, I'll take the under, too. Yeah. Any questions? None. Yeah.
What's that?
Yeah, Dad was the guy with the shotgun. Yeah. So, yeah. Well, hey, and one thing that when people say, your dad's the dad with the shotgun, I remember when I first got sober, I worked in an outpatient center for young kids, and a lot of kids would tell me, man, if my dad had told me, if you're old enough to work, you're old enough to drink, I'd have kicked his ass. I was like, you don't know my fucking dad, man. You know? Because if anybody's been drunk, when you're really, and I came home pretty drunk a few times, you think that that's going to work. It's going to go your way. It doesn't go your way. You know? It doesn't go your way. So, any other questions besides the shotgun?
You might explain that to people that weren't here.
Oh. No, Dad had just retold a story. Dad had grown up in Los Angeles when he was drinking and not when he was sober. I was there when I was sober. He had the benefit of having a house party one time and deciding it would be a good idea to mix alcohol with firearms. And I'm sure there's some people in this room that have done that. And I remember he introduced me to people. It's funny you bring that up because I didn't believe him for shit about that story for a long time. But he introduced me to a few people that vouched for him. So I can tell you, and they said that was one scary evening. You know, your dad, because he's such a jolly, fun guy, nice guy now, but he was a dick, you know, and a drunk back then. So, yeah. Yeah. Well, you're getting as much mileage out of it as he is, probably, yeah. So, that's good. Any other questions? Yeah, I'm sorry, not any shotgun stories. Yeah.
How long were you sober when you started getting that?
That's a good question. It was right after Derek, my old sponsor, went out. So I had about 3 or 4 years. And I never had panic attacks before then, you know, even when I was drinking, but probably because I had alcohol to soothe that. But then I was put on low-dose Xanax for it because they didn't want me getting addicted to that. But and I had panic attacks, and I'll tell you what, my panic attacks have never flared up when I've been doing what I was told to do or doing what I was supposed to do. They've only flared up when I don't work a program, I don't come to meetings, I don't call, you know, my sponsor, I don't reach out to other people. Because then my, you know, I always talk about my dad because I was raised by him, and my program was influenced by him. He always told me, Aaron, your head's never going to tell you anything good. And he was so right about that, because if I have long enough to think about me, it's never going to go to, man, I bet all this is going to work out for you, Aaron. You know, I bet all this shit's just going to come back around and be great, you know. And I'll tell you one great thing Joe, my sponsor, told me, is that's all ego. I came into AA thinking the ego was one thing, and I was totally wrong. I thought ego was, man, Aaron's so great, or having this high opinion of yourself. But ego, he put it in the best way I've heard, is feeling like you're separate from others. Feeling like you are so unique that none of the other good things that happen to everybody else are going to happen for you. It's that separation because you don't have a connection with a higher power or other people. You think you're different from other people. And that's what I had. I had a tremendous ego, but I was manically depressed. You know, so I didn't think they went together, but they go hand in hand. You know, so that's, any other questions?
When was the obsession
lifted? Of alcohol? I would tell you that it took a while. You know, thank you so much. I sweat like no other. You know, my dad's a heavy guy, but he didn't sweat at all. I would say it took a couple of years because I wasn't working a program. So how can I have an obsession of something lifted because I haven't been given anything else to replace it? You know, I was dry, but dry is not happy. You know, I now that I'm longer in sobriety, I always mix up saying sobriety and happiness because they go hand in hand. I'm much more concerned with trying to be happy today. You know, it's always unconditional me being sober, but sobriety in me means so much more now. It's not just being dry, because that was not happy for me. That was horrible. You know, it's like I said, anybody who's had long-term sobriety, had the unfortunate state of having long-term sobriety without working a program, will relate to that you feel worse than you did when you were drinking and trying to quit. Because you have more fear inside you, because you think everything you've been told, it's not, like I said, that's what I thought. This whole program that worked for my parents, that worked for everybody else, it's just not going to, that's just too hard to believe that it would work out for me. You know, because I'm that big of a piece of shit. That's what I was thinking, honestly. So the obsession maybe for drinking didn't lift until I finally did some of those that work. Anything else? Yeah, I did think I was too young. And I've worked with a lot of kids that said the same thing about I'm too young to be sober, but it's what I said before. I would hope you would just listen to how you felt, because I have plenty of friends. We sat through whatever you call them, speakers in high school for drug awareness and alcohol and in groups and things like that, and they're still drinking, and I will talk to them today, and they never thought at all about it. It never occurred to them. But I remember sitting and listening to a speaker and being like, God, it kind of sounds like me, but there's no way. It's no way it's me. You know, I'm horribly depressed. I have a low self-esteem. You know, I'm never happy. I need this to be happy. That's kind of like me, but not. He's 45. I'm 16, 17. You know, or I've got time to make it up. And I'll share one story I will share is I've got a cousin who's a few years younger than me that OD'd on heroin up in San Francisco pretty recently. And his was the same thing where he thought, you know, I've got a run in me. I've got X amount of time to figure it out, you know, and it's not always blessed to us. I'm thankful that I didn't get in a lot of the drugs that hard, but nothing's guaranteed, you know. But I had that a lot, thinking I was too young. So, anything else?
What do you do when somebody asks you
to sponsor them? What do I do when somebody asks me to sponsor them? I don't do is Dad pretty much interviews them, see if he wants to. You know, I'm still kind of glad somebody would ask me to sponsor them, you know, and it's still an honor. And when somebody asks me to sponsor them, I still just, you know, want to get a background and still do want to see if they really want it. Because that was one great thing somebody told me a long time ago. This isn't for people who needed it. If people who needed it filled these rooms, we'd need, like, the Coliseum and huge arenas. But that's not who ends up here. People who end up here really want it, and that's the people that stay, you know. People who need it, unfortunately, and that's one thing I learned going right from getting sober to working at that outpatient center. Of all the people, I probably worked with hundreds of kids, and probably two or three are sober. One's got really great long-term sobriety. The other two, I think, are okay, too. But one's got great long-term sobriety. But that taught me, and the counselor I worked with said, you can't keep anybody sober, and you can't get anybody sober. You know, you are purely working with them, and if they get sober, that's on them and somebody else upstairs. You know, I don't take any credit for it because it's not deserved. So. In Bakersfield, I go to the Noon, as Bill sees it, is a really good one. I go to that one pretty regularly. And then there's a speaker meeting on Friday or Saturday night I try and catch. But I try and do two or three when I can. You know, it doesn't always happen, but try to. So. Anything else? Sorry, I cut it short.
Hey, Mark.
Mark.
When you had that panic attack issue with your fourth step,
mm-hmm.
Had you done a fifth step, or were you still in the fourth step?
Still in the fourth, yeah. So, but I know trust for me was a big thing. I think it's asking a tremendous amount to come in and meet someone you don't know at all and then try and give them everything bad about you right off the bat. And it's not the first thing you do, but it's pretty close. And people that don't know about AA, that learn about it, think that blows their mind that you would do it. You know, but I tell you what, there's no greater relief you're going to get until you unload everything. You know, because holding back, I know a lot of people say, you know, just save it for the next step or the next time around. But man, if it's that bad, I'd go to anybody. I'd go to a priest. I'd go to a psychiatrist. I'd go to anybody you want to talk to. It's my best suggestion. So, anything else?
You had your burning bush moment in your last dream.
Yeah.
What brought you to that? When you woke up, what brought you to that point?
To feel it.
What brought you to that clarity moment that this was going to be my last dream?
I think if you, and like I said, I've been going to AA meetings for about 4 or 5 months before that happened, and it's really hard to have a happy drink when you've got that in your head, you know? So you've got that accumulating, but like I said, I knew guys that sat in the meetings with me that maybe just got a DUI, they didn't really have a problem drinking and things like that. That wasn't messing with them like it was messing with me, because it all made sense. And I was still fighting that tide that, no, it's not me, it's not me. And that's probably what brought that about, that moment of clarity that our book talks about, or that everybody talks about, was probably that it finally flooded in, and as we always say, that I surrendered, you know, and that's the best word to describe it, because it truly is just having to finally give up, you know, because what I was doing, if what I was doing was working, I wouldn't have felt like that. You know, that's the best evidence. If, you know, that's a great thing that Dad always has told me when working with people, though, is ask them if what they're doing is working. You know, ask them if everything's going right, then why are you talking to me? A guy once told me, no one wins the lottery coming in here. You know, no one's showing up with everything going great and things like that. It's usually come so far off the rails, and they're just trying to, you know, hold on that string just for a little bit longer, you know. But, yeah, that's probably what led to that moment for me.